Didn't want to be pushed around anymore. We'd really been pushed around into a corner, and we could see that there was no point in going on if we were never going to get nothing out of it for another 7 years. You're a refugee. It's like you've had to leave one place and go to another without really wanting to. You know, in order to survive, you had to go to another place. I think I was probably thinking to myself in some sense there that I didn't think I had to live that way or had to cower down and run away. Hello, we need your attention. This is Tom Petty of the Heartbreakers, and we're in the studio for Damn the Torpedoes.
1979 was a year in which American popular music was trying to redefine itself. Disco was still dominating the charts then, but it was also the year that the first significant ripples from England's punk movement were being felt in the American musical mainstream. There was a whole new generation of underground bands beginning to bubble up. Many of them relied heavily on the sounds of synthesizers, others on three-chord thrashing guitar, and somehow they all got lumped together in an indefinable mask some called the New Wave. Well, at first, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were thrown into that pot as well. But their breakthrough album in 1979, Damn the Torpedoes, separated them from all of that. Damn the Torpedoes, produced by Jimmy Iovine, firmly established Petty and the Heartbreakers as a band who understood the essence of American rock and roll. It was a return to the solid songwriting and no-nonsense guitar sounds of the 1960s, and its success marked a resurgence of interest in rock and roll's roots. Tom Petty himself grew up in Gainesville, Florida, when he was part of a band called Mudcrutch. In 1974, when he was just 22, Petty moved to Los Angeles trying to find a record deal. Mudcrutch broke up in the process, but Petty, guitarist Mike Campbell, and keyboard player Ben Montench reformed as the Heartbreakers, adding drummer Stan Lynch and bass player Ron Blair, trying to make their way in the L.A. music scene.
We came from Gainesville, Florida, you know. It was just nowhere, really, in music business terms. And we were always like, well, we may be from Gainesville, Florida, but we really know how to play, you know. And we want you to listen, and we had to be a little bit arrogant. You really had to know how to play there. If you lived down there and played, you really had to know how to play, or you'd be booed off. When we came to Hollywood and just, you know, and started living out here, we'd see bands that just couldn't even tune up. You know, we used to have this joke that if, you know, you could get five guys and get them the right haircuts, that it would all work out fine.
It's all right.
The Heartbreakers released their first album on Shelter Records in 1976, and at first, it was a bigger hit in England than in America. So Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers went there to tour.
We went over to England and spent a lot of time there touring around, you know. At the same time we were there was when Johnny Rotten and all those bands were coming out. We were in England, we were somewhat of a strange thing to everybody there because we were the only American group anything vaguely like doing what we do. I think they'd seen the Ramones and Blondie were the other two groups that were playing around. So we were kind of put in. I don't think they called anybody New Wave then. They didn't have that term until about a year later. Yeah. And that was just sort of invented for everybody that they knew wasn't punk, but they didn't know where else to put them.
Real-life take about the late Ike Turner, a notorious womanizer, hitting on Petty's then-wife, Listen to Her Heart received significant radio play off of the Heartbreakers' second album in 1978 called You're Gonna Get It. But before their next album was released, Tom Petty would have to survive a nightmarish series of legal battles over his recording contract. It began in 1978 when ABC Records sold its entire catalog, including Petty's contract, to MCA Records without Tom's permission. Petty told me he'd never been comfortable with ABC Records anyway.
We were with a bunch of people we didn't know that really didn't understand us. They didn't understand us at all. They wanted me to, the first cover I was wearing a black leather jacket, and they wanted to redo the cover without it, you know, because punk bands were coming around and, they didn't want us to be associated with that. And we were on a lot of shows with those groups, and we like them. And but we didn't think that we should, you know, shave our heads or anything because we were just Southern guys, you know.
The first top 10 hit from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Don't Do Me Like That, was from their third album, Damn the Torpedoes. It almost didn't make it on the album.
I'd written that years before.
Really?
Yeah, I'd written that for Mudcrutch, really.
Wow.
So that was just played as a joke, and it was only there was only two takes, I think. It wasn't on the album, even when we were assembling the album at the end. And Tori Swenson, who was the second engineer on the album, bless his heart, I still see him every now and then. And I always remind him that he was kind of, you know, the second engineer doesn't usually have the right to speak out or anything. And he's going, I really think there's one track that ought to be on there that's not on there. And we go, you know, well, this is, what is it? And he says, that song you played, Don't Do Me Like That, I really think you ought to get that tape out and play it again. And we went, no. And he said, I know I'm out of line here, and I know I'm not supposed to say anything, but I really think you should listen to that song. And so Jimmy goes, okay, play the song, and he played it, and then we all went, well, that's not too bad.
Don't Do Me Like That was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' first top 10 hit. But as Tom will reveal coming up next, it's a miracle that it ever got out. For this and more of your favorite rock star interviews, visit InTheStudio.net. Find In The Studio on Facebook. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' Damn the Torpedoes.
Hello, we need your attention. This is Tom Petty of the Heartbreakers, and we're in the studio for Damn the Torpedoes.
I'm Redbeard, and in the midst of recording Damn the Torpedoes, Tom Petty sued his record company, claiming that they couldn't sell him to another label without his permission. The record company countersued, demanding repayment on several $100,000 that Petty and the Heartbreakers had been advanced to make the first two albums. The high-stakes legal maneuvering would drag on for 9 months.
No one had ever challenged, I think, their right to do this, and I did that. Even to the point of where at one point I had to declare bankruptcy because I figured that, well, if you're saying I owe you all this money in advances and I can't pay it, then I must be legally bankrupt, right? I just didn't want to be pushed around anymore.
There you go.
We'd really been pushed around into a corner and we could see that there was no point in going on if we were never going to get nothing out of it for another 7 years.
7 years?
You know, we said, well, I'm not going to go along with that. And so did take forever. It started that way and it mushroomed into this crazy case that was being covered in the media. And then I realized how big it was getting. I got an incredible education in the music business during those days, though, because I really was at every meeting and I was there with all these, you know, at one point there was 12 lawyers at one table. And it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then the other thing that complicated us was the other record companies started coming in and going, well, here, you know, listen, we'll give you this if you'll just come over to us and forget about that. And so it got real complicated. But in the meantime, we were making a record.
I think she loves me.
Shadow of a Doubt comes from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' 1979 album Damn the Torpedoes. According to Tom, the David versus Goliath nature of the lawsuits with his first record company only strengthened the band's resolve to make it.
I think, looking back, you don't realize it at the time, it made us a very tight little bunch of fellows at the time. We didn't know if we'd ever make another record or if we'd ever even see this one come out. We spent months and months wondering if it'd even come out. In those days, and still I think to some extent, we really just wanted, you just want to make it so you can take the tapes home and play it and go, yeah, it's great, you know. You just want to do that. We weren't looking much further ahead than that.
At one point, an injunction was handed down from the court preventing the Heartbreakers from even performing in concert. Tom Petty felt as if he were under siege.
We weren't getting any help from anybody. But we knew that we were selling out shows all over America, and we weren't getting any help from anybody at all. You know, we were just completely self-contained thing. So then they slapped all these injunctions on me and stuff where I couldn't even perform live.
Really? You were prevented?
I was prevented completely. At one point, I had to go out and do some gigs
just to pay the rent,
and I had to go to court and take the stand and make a plea, you know, to the judge to get permission to go out for so-and-so weeks, because they'd say, well, if he can go out and play 2 weeks, then we should get the money. And I'd say, well, look, you know, we've got to live. We can't, you know. So anyway, I remember being there on the stand in court, which is a real strange experience. It ain't like TV when you're up there.
What is it like?
Oh, it's terrible, because you can't say everything on your mind. They won't permit you to just talk and say, well, look, here's this guy over there, you know, screwing me around, because you just can't go into it that way. But I remember him asking me, the lawyer, saying, well, listen, if you're going to do that, what security can you give me that, you know, the money's going to be used for this? I said, there ain't no security in rock and roll. And the judge started laughing, and he said, okay, go ahead and play your shows, you know.
Cool, Jeff.
And, yeah, I gave him a platinum record, that judge.
We'll be right back.
You Tell Me was a brooding song from Damn the Torpedoes featuring legendary Memphis bass player Duck Dunn. It wasn't easy recording Damn the Torpedoes under the constant threat of injunctions and court orders. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers had to employ some drastic measures to make sure their music would be protected.
We used to have to put fake names on the tapes so they couldn't come in the studio and grab the tapes.
You're not serious.
Oh, yeah, I'm dead serious.
No,
we'd write weird names on the boxes, and so when they're stored in the lockers, nobody could come in and grab them. And there was one point where the marshals were looking for me, and they were going to take the tapes away. They had a court order to seize my tapes. So I'd put them in the back of Bugs' station wagon and tell him to just drive off with him. And this is like lots of boxes of two-track tape. And we'd load them in Bugs' station wagon and say, and I knew I had to go on court in the morning, and I'd say, well, just drive off, you know, and I don't want to know where you are. So they'd put me on the stand and go, all right, where's the tapes? I go, I don't know. And so how can you know? You know, you're lying. I'd go, no, I'm not lying. I don't know where they are. And that's how I could say that on the stand.
And not perjure yourself.
And not perjure myself, because I'd just give them to Bugs and tell him to drive off with them.
It just sounds like some kind of
bizarre
Hollywood.
It got more and more and more bizarre, because then you realize you're messing with some pretty big and powerful guys. And you start wondering what's going to happen to you for doing it. Nobody ever threatened me outright. I think there were threats made, you know. I remember one fella, you know, telling me, you'll never be nothing, you know, that I'll see that, you know, you never work again, all that stuff. And I said, well, to tell you the truth, I'd rather sell peanuts on the beach, if that's the way it is, than give you all this money. I'm not going to give it to you. So if I'm not going to work anymore, then so be it. But I'm going to go down trying to do it. And I meant that, because I really had nothing to lose at all, I didn't think, by doing all this. You know, if they got their way, I was completely out of the game. So I didn't think I had anything to lose.
Reach out and grab hold of something. Yeah, I just catch myself wondering, waiting, worrying about some silly little things don't add up to nothing.
What happened with that one was Mike Campbell really should get the most credit for the track. You know, he had the idea of how the piano would go and how it would play, and really all in his head, you know, and the little guitar go clang, 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 clang. And I kept thinking, well, you can't really sing much to that. And for some reason, you know, nobody'd ever, even I can't believe this, but I think it was Debbie Harry. We were playing a bunch of shows with them at the Whiskey. We used to open up for Blondie. And she did a lot of stuff where she'd talk instead of sing. And I don't know what some, but she's just sometimes, I don't even know if she did it on the records, but sometimes in the club she'd just start talking through a song. And I remember thinking, that's pretty cool. I think I was thinking of Debbie when I had the idea to start talking. There's a lot of pain in the song, but it's just about how whatever, you know, here comes my girl or my guy or whatever can really, is all that's ever going to stay constant and lift you out of that, whatever the problems are, that it's that nice thing about romance, you know, that you can... It can lift you above all that. So really, I think this album was meant to be inspirational in some sense in all the things that they said about it. But doing it was a little more innocent than that. I don't think we aspired to those great aspirations at the time, but I can see now that the most pleasing thing about that song to me is we didn't play that song for years. We played it in those days, and then we stopped. And on the last tour we did, we did that song again. And I'd see the people just, you know, all the chorus had come, and they'd all hug their girls and guys, you know, and they'd all be, you know, and I thought, oh, well, that's nice, you know, that makes them all hug each other and smile, you know.
Still to come, Tom Petty reveals the ugly truths about the dark underside of the ruthless music business and the staggering cost to stand up for his band. For this and more, you can visit InTheStudio.net. Find In The Studio on Facebook. I'm Redbeard with Tom Petty for the anniversary of Rolling Stone magazine's number 309 album on its top 500 all-time list, Damn the Torpedoes.
Welcome back to In the Studio, and I'm Tom Petty with Redbeard.
The game-changing album, Damn the Torpedoes, which was eventually released in October 1979. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers did win the right to a new contract, and Petty's refusal to back down was a blow for musician rights everywhere. But at what cost?
We had over $1 million in legal bills.
Say that again, please.
There was at least $1 million paid, maybe more, to the lawyers. Just our side. There was, you know, huge settlements and, they, you know, so we were really lucky, really, that it was a big hit. Or we'd have still been broke the rest of our lives, you know, because we didn't have $1 million.
That is just so far away from my comprehension. Yeah.
And mine. It was very far away from my comprehension at the time, but I just wasn't going to give up. I really like playing rock and roll. I still do, even now in my old age. And I'm not qualified to do anything else either, so I don't know what I would have done. But to me, it's all I ever wanted to do, and I wasn't going to let some lawyers or guys that don't even know anything about the music, or they don't know the song or the tune, they just own them. I wasn't going to let them say, well, you just can't do this. We're going to make sure you just don't do nothing for being a bad boy. You're not going to do anything. And it all sounds a little bit melodramatic, but it really was like that. I saw things nobody'd believe then, you know. I saw lawyers throw lawyers against walls in the parking lot. I saw them fist fight. I saw all sorts of things, you know.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah, I saw things that you wouldn't believe. I saw lawyers caught in collusions and people having to leave firms. And it's nothing I'd ever want to go through, I'll tell you. I'm not nearly that close to the record business since then. I've never been interested in it at all. I just make my records, and I made a deal where I can make a record and turn it in. And I don't, no one really talks anything about it, and I just turn it in and hope they like it. But, you know, it was a real crazy thing. But the nice thing is that a good record came of it.
Couldn't live that
the really nice, innocent thing about those days was you didn't sit around and try to write an album before. We just show up, and I'd go, well, okay, let me see. I got something that goes like this. And I remember doing Even the Losers when I didn't really have the chorus in my head, so I'd just be singing, and we'd be playing it, and then slowly it all banged in my head.
So a lot of Damn the Torpedoes was more or less written from ideas that you brought to the studio?
Yeah, and a lot of... We've always, the Heartbreakers always, you know, were arrogant enough to just write albums in the studio. They never were a very cost-conscious bunch. They're still not. So a lot of those early albums especially, the love songs were just used as a way to keep from sounding like I was grandstanding or trying to moralize, which I've always hated that. I hate these records that moralize. You know, I hate that. I can't stand it. But if it's done in a way, say with a sense of humor or through a love song, I really always dug records that I might take them in on this level. And if I listen longer, I go, oh, well, I see this could apply to even that, you know. And that was the idea that I'd never really come on until I got to Damn the Torpedoes. You know, it was an important album for me in a lot of ways because it opened up what I was doing before that. And the other albums, I think they really were love songs, you know, or they're really innocent, those first couple albums in a lot of ways. And that's when you're just trying to learn about the studio and do this and that. But here I hit on something that I thought, oh, well, this is kind of my own style and I can develop this and take it somewhere and see what I can get out of it. So it was very important to me in that sense. When I realize, you know, it's just like a bolt of lightning into the brain when you realize, oh, you know, I can really expand on this and do something with it, you know, and maybe even say something with it if I'm lucky. it was about how you've been kicked around and all that, and having to live as though you're a refugee. Is like you've had to leave one place and go to another without really wanting to, you know, in order to survive. You've had to go to another place. I think I was probably singing to myself in some sense there that I didn't think I had to live that way or had to cower down and run away. And that's really what it was about. It was as simple as that. And once that word hit me, the song was written in minutes. I mean, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes is all that ever went into that song. Sometimes I wish I'd put another hour into it and made it even better, but that's probably the way it was meant to be. Jimmy Iovine was just, that was the first thing I played him when he showed up at the studio, and he'd say, well, I'm going to get that song. Right, we did over 200 something takes on Refugee. Not in one day. It went on the whole album. We never thought we had Refugee as well as it should be. And I think when they counted through all the tape, there was over 200 takes and versions.
No, I've yeah. never heard of that.
Me either. I hope I never do it again. But I hope I never have to go through that again. But it was worth it in the end. I think it was in the final days of the album when we actually got that down the way we wanted it. I remember we all just were really excited when we got it the way we wanted it. We played it over and over and over.
This is Redbeard in the studio. Ever since receiving the shocking and terrible news of Tom Petty's sudden death from fentanyl overdose in October 2017, I've been trying to assess the scope of the loss, both culturally and personally, and failing miserably. But while preparing this 45th anniversary interview for Damn the Torpedoes, I realized that Tom Petty himself had summed up my feelings exactly in one of our last conversations.
They are just one. We're very proud. I'm very proud of the Heartbreakers in that they haven't gotten too honky over the last 10 years or whatever it's been now. They're a real rock and roll group, and they don't do beer ads, and they don't, you know, they just want to play rock and roll music. We never really wanted to do anything else. We're not really don't have our eyes on the movies or anything. We just want to make rock records and do rock and roll shows. It's just such a simple thing. That's all. We've always been a simple unit. We're not simple people necessarily, maybe simple minded, but we're just a band, and we write songs and try to play them. It's harder than it sounds. These days, most people play with machines and, you know, they have it all programmed into a computer. And
how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that's fine if that's what you like to do. I'm a little tired of that. We don't do that. We always prefer to really bang the drum and to really play it and perform it, because there's just something that you get that way that I don't think, I know to my style of music, it wouldn't complement what I do. But I do hear people that do it, and I think, yeah, I mean, I don't have any criticism of the means as long as the end is
sure.
great.
Sure.
You know, it's all music. Yeah. If you make it come out great, I couldn't criticize you for that. I'd be doing it in a minute, but we're just a little bit, maybe, I don't know if it's old-fashioned, but we just kind of want to always just really play it and perform it as live as possible. And they are, the Heartbreakers are really a great live group. But they're really a lot of what I've gotten credit, maybe, in some cases. But without them, it wouldn't really be the same, you know. You can't really, you need to play like they play with, the intensity they play with. And, you know, it's so fierce and strong, you know, that when you play with other groups, you learn, you know, that's a real special conglomerate of guys there. So I think I'm just proud that they're still together. After years go by like this, you start to just treasure things so much. You know, I don't want to see it end. I want to see us go back out and, all right, come on, gig, you know, showtime, 8 o'clock, you know, let's keep playing. Because if we stop for too long, I just feel like it'll evaporate and go away.
This is Redbeard, thanking Tom Petty for graciously sharing his time, thoughts, and insights into the creative process with me since 1978. Many thanks to longtime manager Tony Dimitriotis and his team for decades of access to set the stage for these interviews to happen. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved. Find In the Studio with Redbeard on Facebook, on Spotify as a podcast, and online at inthestudio.net.